Hello, subscribers, and welcome back to your bespoke Inside Total Film podcast. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and I've got with me today reviews editor Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And also our online entertainment editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello, gentlemen. Coming up in this episode, we're chatting about puking in movies, Maleficent 2, Peanut Butter Falcon, and we'll be talking to Joel Edgerton about Netflix Game of Thrones version of English history, The King. But first, let's discuss barfing. Okay, so in no particular order, our top five puke scenes in movies includes, well, one of my favourites, Bridesmaids. I mean, obviously, puking is not a thing we want to watch, but this is a very funny scene, right?
Yes, this is absolutely probably the centrepiece of Paul Feig's comedy. And I think the thing to remember about this one, it's not just a great puking scene, it's a great diarrhea scene as well.
Yeah.
So you get double trouble in this one.
Yeah, and in wedding dresses, so yes, and on absolutely. White carpets.
Yes, Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph both excel themselves, as it were.
Also in our top five, Stand By Me, which includes the barf-a-rama of the pie-eating
Lardass.
Contest.
Lardass
set
is
that
revenge.
Up for me, Matthew. What happens there?
Our puker-in-chief is Lardass. But unbeknownst to the crowd watching, he's downed a load of castor oil beforehand. So he's not only, he's got a gut full of blueberry pie, but it's going to make a quick resurgence. And he starts puking over his opponents. And then the judges start puking over each other. Then everybody in the stand starts puking over each other. So it's a great big cesspool of blueberry vomit.
I mean, it is like a story within this story
and yes.
and not necessarily real. But it does tap into that fear we all have when you see someone being sick or you smell it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The dry heaves start. Are you aware of this one, Jack? Are you too young?
I'm just staying silent because I'm feeling quite ill.
Are you feeling nauseous already?
This entire conversation is putting me that way. But yeah, you know, imagining blueberry puke running around everywhere.
Mm. I have to say, these don't really bother me. Because I rewatched all these while eating yogurt and it didn't really have an effect on me, I have to say.
Maybe it was the good bacteria.
Yeah.
The good bacteria was helping you out there.
Yeah, it's weird, yeah. Anything to do with eyes and fingers, I'm squeamish about, but puke doesn't bother me so much.
Okay.
I don't know what it says about me.
What about skidding around in puke? Because Team America has that amazing scene with the puppet prodigiously throwing up.
Yes, for sheer duration.
Sheer duration. This one, it's particularly comic though, isn't it? I guess seeing the puppets going around everywhere. Yeah, another centerpiece of puke in a movie.
It's a classic example of something that starts out funny, gets repetitive, stops being funny, but then carries on and then it gets funny again.
Yes.
So it's
got that Family Guy sort of element of it going out of funny and back into it.
Just flogging it mercilessly.
Yeah, until it's funny again. Mm. I love it. What about the classic one, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, Mr. Creosote and his Wafer Thin Mint?
His Wafer Thin. I think this was a movie that my parents introduced me to very young, and they thought it was really funny watching me being grossed out by it. But it is like, it's such a great scene.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's a classic. It still holds up as well. I quite like how all these selections so far have been just so over the top puking. Because the most recent puke thing, which I think you gave your award to in one of these podcasts,
I did.
In It Chapter 2, wasn't it? With
Bill Hader.
Bill Hader throwing up over the side, which is like a nice little puke.
Yeah,
but
a realistic puke.
Yeah.
This is my beef, that I'm sick of people in films throwing up just a mouthful. Because nobody throws up just a mouthful.
Instead, they blow up with it going everywhere.
Yeah,
got to have a gusher.
Got to have a gusher. Thank you, Matthew. Speaking of that, what about the fly? That's
pretty repulsive.
That is disgusting.
That is pretty nasty. Seth Brundle, he's become a human fly, and flies puke on their food in order to digest it. And he does it on a person, does it on their hand and then on their foot. And it's pretty nasty. Watching the flesh corrode off the bone is not nice. But it holds up very well.
Yeah, it's 30 years on. Hugely memorable.
Mm.
And sort of that body horror aspect of that film really condensed into a disgusting moment. So out of our five puke scenes, what do we think is the corker most memorable?
I'm going to go for Bridesmaids, I think, because it's an ensemble effort as well. It's set up really well. Some great performances.
As much as I like The Meaning of Life, I'm probably going to have to agree with Bridesmaids because it is just so gross, but also one of the funniest scenes in a recent comedy as well. It's just so good.
And great to see women do the gross out comedy, and it's not just the preserve of the gentleman. Mm. I agree. Bridesmaids is the winner of our puking scenes. If you have an opinion, do let us know via Twitter. We'd love to know what you think. And now, strong stomachs, everyone. Let's take a little listen to Bridesmaids vomiting. Okay, time to clean it up. Let's talk new releases. So first of all, let's all bow down for this.
Already I can feel the weight of this crown I wear. I've been forced to rely upon the council of men whose loyalty I question every waking moment. I need men around me I can trust.
That, of course, was David Michaud's The King. Set it up for us, Jack. What is this about?
This is the story of Hal, or Henry the Fifth.
The Fifth.
He ends up being Henry the Fifth, but it's him becoming king after his father, Henry the Fourth, loses power. And Henry is played by Timothy Chalamet, the younger Henry. And it's his story about fighting the French.
Yeah. It's basically condensing the Henriad, as the plays are known, of Henry the Fourth, part one, Henry the Fourth, part two, and Henry the Fifth into this 2-hour opus that they've sort of reinvented Shakespeare, twisted it to their own devices, really modernized it, and made some changes to characters that probably Shakespeare scholars may not be happy with.
Well, it's interesting that obviously it's three Henry films, but the majority of it is Henry the Fifth, right? Because there's the very beginning of the film, it brushes over a lot of stuff very quickly. The first film in the scene introduces a lot of major characters, or you think are going to be major characters, and then we don't really see most of them again. It's kind of like, here's a quick setup of something turbulent going on in Henry the Fourth's world, and then we don't really hear about it again until ever. Like Henry, he's kind of done away with quite quickly, and then it's the Timothy Chalamet show.
Yeah, and it sort of doesn't really use much of Henry the Fourth part one, which I did for my exams at school, which is all about sort of Hal carousing and not wanting to be king. We just have Chalamet being miserable in Cheapside with prostitutes for a second before he's suddenly called to court. So it is, yeah, it's more Henry the Fifth. Let's hear from Joel Edgerton, who actually wrote the film, about what it took to bring this interpretation to screen. He spoke to our Hollywood reporter, Adam Tanswell.
Well, it started off when I had this idea, maybe it was 7 or 8 years ago, to tell the story of Henry the Fifth. I mean, it even started longer ago. I did the Shakespeare plays Henry IV, 1 and 2 and Henry the Fifth. And I had this idea of making a movie about Henry V in some way and talked to David about it. And he was excited about the idea too. But to not just do a Shakespeare film, but to kind of talk about that, then look at the real history and then create our own story, in fact, manipulate our own version of things. But to tell a visually a period film, period setting, but create our own story and our own machinations of that. And that's been a long process.
So there we go. That was Joel talking about the long process of bringing this film to screen. Does it work? Do we like this manipulation of Shakespeare? I mean, that's what Shakespeare did with history itself. He created art that wasn't necessarily reflective of the truth. So is Joel doing the same thing with Shakespeare, Jack?
I mean, I haven't read or seen all the Shakespeare Henry plays, but the film feels incredibly bloated, and it would work much better if they just made it into a TV show rather than a movie, because they try and cram in so much stuff, but then suddenly characters will make decisions that make no sense because you haven't had the build-up there.
You don't have the context.
And you're just trying to get from point to point. And it's interesting because Joel was saying about wanting to make Shakespeare something new but still take the bones of that story. But I feel like if you're going to take three huge texts and turn them into a 2-hour film, I don't know, maybe just pick one. It feels like a scattershot approach by kind of picking out small bits and then, but not having any mid-story. It feels like lots of, he says this and now he does it, rather than having the actual decision process and all the middle stuff. I don't know, you're a massive fan of the text though.
Yeah, and I do love the play, and I sort of feel like I don't know that it satisfies either people who are looking for a really great adaptation of that play or people who are looking for a fresh approach, because it's sort of hamstrung by the fact that it does still cleave closely to various parts of it and then not to others. There's massive changes in one particular character that changes the dynamic entirely of the two sort of between Hal and Falstaff, played by Joel Edgerton. So it's like, why? I don't know why you didn't just do something completely different instead of trying to do this halfway house. It's also just interesting that they've decided to cast somebody so young as Timothy Chalamet as the king, because obviously he has a lot to do here, and it's quite a wide arc he has to go through, from boy who's messing around in Cheapside to this leader of the English army. I'm not sure it's totally successful.
I didn't think it was very successful at all, to be honest. Mm. I mean, I like Timmy. I feel like everyone likes Timmy. It's hard.
We
not
have a lot of goodwill for Timmy
right now,
right?
He is having a moment, but he is so young, and to be leader of a country. I mean, first he's going around sleeping with all these women and getting drunk and stuff, which I can believe because every young man loves to do that.
Oh,
but then,
hello.
Not maybe not every you know some, but
Mrs. Shepherd, please don't listen to this podcast.
Then when he suddenly turns from that person into being, you know, he's this reticent, not wanting to be king, and then suddenly he turns into, I own this, I am this, this is me now, I'm gonna fight someone on the battlefield and then I'm gonna win somehow
and be excellent at it. And that's, I think that's what I found really difficult, because obviously if you were to watch those plays, that's a long period of time in which to see that arc from boy to leader king, and we don't get the time to do it in this film, so you're there left trying to understand how this wastrel, as somebody calls him, is suddenly a great fighter and a great leader and a great strategist.
But this is what I'm so confused by, because it just happens in, it's all like blink and you miss it, and then suddenly he's there. And then the next scene, then he becomes the king, hence the title. But he was so reticent and hated all the monarchy and didn't want any part of it. And then suddenly he is that, and he accepts it in a way that later on in the film, when they're at the Battle of Agincourt and things like that, and he's wanting people to be flayed and all this. It's just this crazy arc for him that I don't really understand. And then suddenly, at that point, part of him wants to go back and be like, oh, we shouldn't be this vicious and we shouldn't be horrible medieval men, but then we should do that again. I don't know, it just felt a bit
hurried and rushed.
Yes.
So we gave it 3 stars in the magazine. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's totally fair. You know, let's face it, this is a very starry cast. You know, Netflix have the big bucks to get the big names in. And so from that point of view, from a sort of, you know, historical drama that's starring a lot of famous folk, it's ticking all the boxes. Mm. Let's listen to what Joel had to say about casting Timothy Chalamet as Hal.
You know, I played Hal in 98, 99, I was about 26. And Henry became king at a very young age. And it became very important to us as we were developing the script to go, let's find a very young king. It was going to be, also mean a lot to two things. One was the optimism of a person who's young, who thinks they can change the world and they can do things differently. And in this case, change the way he rules to eclipse his own father, who he doesn't appreciate his policy. But then also just the vulnerability of seeing someone so young being in what I call the kind of room of sharks, which is all of his advisors, and watching him grow in power and be drunk, almost drunk on power to a certain degree, or to kind of become blind to what's going on. And I think it was a really great choice. It's really interesting to watch someone so young take on a mantle so important.
So, Jack, what did you think about the casting of Chalamet?
As much as he's, I would say, slightly miscast, he still gives a good as performance as he can give. There's a real scene during one of the big battles when Bolcott Chalamet kind of charges in and suddenly shows off these borderline ninja skills of killing other men. And it's so unbelievable that it's quite distracting. The problem is, the film is shot so beautifully.
It's beautiful, yeah.
It looks stunning.
And the production values, and, you know, it feels very visceral, the battle scenes, and muddy and dirty and disease-ridden, and there's child deaths. But then in amidst this is Chalamet sort of as a ninja.
Yeah, it's a shame about him. Like, I'm not the biggest fan of Timmy in this film, but I'm a big fan of some of the other cast members, in particular Robert Pattinson.
So good. This is a debatable thing. People either love or hate his performance, don't they?
It all hinges on the accent.
Mm.
I adore it. I think it's amazing.
I loved it. Let's give the context of this. He turns up in a blonde wig, doing a Pepe Le Pew accent and talking about the young king's balls.
What is not to love?
And, you know, everyone else is very much playing this in a very same way. Everyone's made a deliberate choice about this. We're all going to talk very quietly and very seriously. And Patterson turns up and makes this bold choice to go completely in the other direction. And it's actually really entertaining. I thought it was really entertaining.
I agree. I mean, it feels like he's in a completely different movie. But it's great because he just comes out. He's like, oh, little boy, I will cut off your bollocks. And you're just like, amazing.
This is
Timmy just standing there, just looking at him, just going, oh, I don't know what to say. And
yeah. Great. I mean, and also, you know, Chalamet is doing English accent impeccably. Well done.
Yeah.
And Pattinson decided to do a French accent that wasn't, but that's fine because it's funny.
This is a warm up for Batman, do you think? Are we looking at
Oh, will he be breaking out the French for Batman?
That's what I'm wondering.
I mean, he is magnetic on screen. You cannot take your eyes off him. So from that point of view, if we're looking at him for Batman, he really does hold your attention when he's on screen, and you're not looking at anyone else when he's there. So yeah, he's great. I actually wondered if it wouldn't have been better if they'd swapped Chalamet and Pattinson's roles and Chalamet played the Dauphin and Pattinson played Henry, because it feels like he might have brought more heft to that, especially with all the films he's made more recently. You know, we don't remember Twilight now really about Robert Pattinson. And bearing in mind what he did with The Lighthouse, then he might have made some really interesting choices with Henry.
And is it going to appeal to the Game of Thrones crowd? I mean, our review mentions that.
It has a lot of the kind of boardroom politics scenes where you have people kind of talking about the strategies and why France is annoyed at England and why England should fight back and that kind of stuff. So that is very early Game of Thrones-esque. And then the battle scenes themselves, there's one shot in particular where we're looking down at Joel Edgerton's character and we see him looking up, and it's almost shot for shot from Game of Thrones. And I think it will in those respects. I think it's maybe it doesn't go into quite enough depth for Game of Thrones fans, because obviously that's a show
got
where
you've hours with Game of Thrones to get into.
Yeah, exactly. And you have good female characters in Game of Thrones as well.
Yeah, we've got Lily Rose Depp in this one, just wearing a wimple and doing an excellent French accent, as she should, with a French mother. But what about the resonance of the film? I mean, this is what he had to say about what the film means in today's times.
We can tell a story about what's going on in the government right now in any country, but we may as well just watch that on the news. And I even think Shakespeare at the time, when, you know, you're talking about Shakespeare telling a story of Henry V, or Shakespeare telling a story of Hamlet, it was about telling a story about England at the present time by telling a story about the past, you know. And so we can look at politics and its machinations and its attachment to ego and power through another setting, through a kind of a fantastical world, and yet we can find truth and honesty and resonance in it for us today, I think. You know, and I think there's so much in this movie that speaks to many human things and political things today.
So what do we think? Is it resonant to today's political times, or is it a historical misfire?
I guess it's slightly resonant in that you have two male leaders who both stretching their egos.
And one of them's bonkers.
And one of them's bonkers and has a crazy accent. And you could say that about leaders this side of the pond and on the other. So I guess it's relevant in that
mean.
Way. But neither of them are as handsome as Robert Pattinson, so that takes away a bit. And neither of them are as fun.
No.
I mean, there's all the political manipulation, and obviously that's something that everyone's talking about at the moment. But I don't really know if it says anything deep particularly.
Yeah, I mean, unless you have actually been a monarch, I'm not sure you're going to get much out of it, because it is really about, you know, the heaviness of the crown that you wear and the responsibility. I'm not sure it has particular resonance, but I do think it's probably worth seeing on the big screen, which Netflix are doing with this. It's going to be out in cinemas before you see it at home.
It's 30 years since the Kenneth Branagh Henry V, which is still very well regarded. How do you think it compares to that film?
Very different, I think. It's very difficult to compare the two, because that's so faithful, isn't it? And, you know, like you were saying, Jack, that sort of spectre of Branagh as a man and a fully formed man in full control of an army sort of hangs over Chalamet a little bit. where you're sort of struggling to believe that people would follow him into battle. So that was The King. That's out in cinemas now, but we'll be moving on to Netflix and your screen at home on the 1st of November. So from one American star doing regal in a British accent to another.
There are many who prey on the innocent. I'm sure your kind would agree.
If I didn't know better, I'd say you were making a threat.
Well, do you?
Do I what?
Know better.
So that's Angelina in Maleficent 2, Mistress of Evil. I actually didn't make this screening because I was going to The Irishman, but you boys did.
You did.
Set it up for me. What goes on in this compared to the first one, and is it any good?
Okay, well, this is Maleficent Mistress of Evil, the sequel to the 2014 Maleficent, which was basically a retelling of Sleeping Beauty from Maleficent's point of view. And in this one, her goddaughter, Princess Aurora, is about to marry Prince Philip, who is on the human side. So this wedding will unite the human kingdom and the fairy kingdom, but there's various forces who don't want this to happen.
Various forces meaning Michelle Pfeiffer,
yeah.
Which frankly I find quite exciting as a proposition, Angelina and Michelle going at it.
Yeah, but that is the whole problem with the film, is that they don't go at it often enough or interestingly enough over the course of quite a long 2-hour film.
2 hours, and this is half term fodder. So what does happen?
Well, the first act is actually quite fun because, yeah, this is all about the proposal and bringing the two families together. And there's a very nice dinner scene that's kind of like reminiscent of Shrek when the families get together. And there's a lot of comedy going on. But then it slowly kind of goes off piste. There's a very, very dull midsection where Maleficent finds out about basically her origin story as told to her by others of her kind, but it's lots of talk and not much action. And it's not until the final part of the film where war basically happens that things start to pick up again. So you could lose a good deal from the middle act, I would say.
It feels like there's so many pieces at play in this film. They kind of start, there's this incredible dinner scene, which is really funny. And you've got Michelle and Angelina both being very catty at each other and throwing comments. And
Great side eye.
And it's very, very funny. But then suddenly they introduce Warwick Davis, who's stealing fairies. And then there's winged people. I can't remember their race's name.
Dark Fey fairies.
And then Michelle Pfeiffer has another complete plan going on herself with someone completely different. And then you've got the king himself, and then something happens to him. Then there's Sleeping Beauty herself, Aurora, who is getting married, and then suddenly she has to do something. And then the prince, there's the guy with the prince's friend, who suddenly they
sounds
do
just
something
like
else.
Is there just too much going on? Have they just probarred everything into this?
Yeah, there's too much, but also not enough. There's not enough for everybody to do. There's a lot of exposition, and this is how we got to this point, and without actually moving forward until we get to
the last film, 20, 30 minutes.
It did, yeah, it was huge.
So do you think this one's going to do as well?
No, I don't think as well. I mean, I think I took my son along, my 5-year-old, and he enjoyed it enough. There's a bit with a goat where he wouldn't stop laughing for literally hours afterwards. So,
but is it worth going to a film for just a bit with a goat?
No, I would not say no. If you're paying full price just for a goat, no.
And obviously this is Angelina sort of getting her franchise on.
Yeah.
And she's going to be an Eternal.
That's right, yeah.
So, it's very action-y. We know she can do action, but in costumes, does it give you hope for Eternal?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Because she's great when she's kind of let off the leash. But again, she disappears for great chunks of the film or she's just standing around listening, you know. It doesn't really make the most of what she can do. I mean, when she's good, she's terrific.
She's just not in it enough.
No.
Because they sideline her for all these other stories that are going on. The story just doesn't feel very coherent. It feels like a lot of weird things going on. And then there are some characters who, you know, a lot of people switching sides. And then at the end, it's a big... We won't say.
Don't spoil. No spoilers.
Some of the character choices, it just doesn't really make much sense and doesn't feel like it works within the context of the whole film. So, you know, it's odd.
Okay, well, let's talk about one that does work and does warm the heart. Peanut Butter Falcon.
Are you following me? Maybe we could be friends and buddies, bro dogs and chill. Have a good time.
Let's set this up. What goes on in this?
Peanut Butter Falcon. This is the story of Zach. It was put together for the actor Zach got Sagan, who has Down syndrome. And this is about a story of him. He's in a care home and he basically escapes because he wants to be a wrestler. He's been watching these VHS tapes of how to be a wrestler. So it's his plan. He escapes from this home and he goes on the run and he hooks up with Shia LaBeouf's character, who's also on the run from some not very nice characters, and they have a little adventure, and it's all inspired by Huckleberry Finn. It's like a modern retelling.
This is a real hidden gem, in my opinion. I don't think I've seen Shia LaBeouf as lovely as this on screen for a long time. No. Did you enjoy his performance?
I did, yeah. He's very chilled out. He's great with Zach. There's a lot of nice chemistry there. And Dakota Johnson's in the mix as well. She's Zach's care, and she comes along for the ride. So, yeah, Shia, he's just kind of more relaxed than you've seen him. He seems to be very much back on track, you know, after a few years.
Did it move you, Jack?
Yeah, I was very emotionally moved by this one. I loved it. I thought it was really, nice. And it, especially the bond between Zach and Shia's character. They don't know each other to begin with, but then they form this brotherly bond. And Shia's character has a background as well where he's had a unfortunate past, and they latch onto each other, and it's so nice. I mean, I was nearly in tears throughout quite a big chunk of it, even though there aren't any moments where you're like, oh, this is really sad. It's just lovely.
It is. It's lovely and whimsical, and it doesn't particularly do anything new, but it just does it extremely well.
Yeah, it's a very tight film. Like, there's nothing about it that doesn't work. It's all, and you bump into these really funny characters along the way on this journey who maybe only have one scene or so, like the guy who has the hut and helps them build their boat.
Yeah.
And it just works. It's they all bring something new to the film and make it feel fresh. And even though it's quite not a slowish story, but it's not exactly the most exciting thing. There's no big fights or, well. You know, but there's no big action sequence or anything. Everyone who joins it kind of puts in this certain amount of energy to kind of keep it propelling forward.
Mm.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I really like seeing Thomas Hayden Church. It's great to see him on the big screen. Yeah. He has a kind of small but pivotal role.
Yes.
And Bruce Dern as well. Same goes for him.
Great. So you should definitely seek out Peanut Butter Falcon. It's a goodie. So that's our new releases. And now it's time for the news. Jack, what is big in news this week?
Well, the last 2 weeks, it's all been dominated by the London Film Festival. So there's been tons and tons of incredible films that'll be playing throughout the rest of the year, all debuting at the London Film Festival. And Jane, you were one of the jurors.
I was. I was on the jury for the official competition of this festival. So I had to sit in a room with my fellow jurors and watch 10 films and decide which of those films was the best in competition. And we announced that on Saturday, and the winner was Monos, which is Alejandro Landa's amazing film out of Colombia about child soldiers and the trials and tribulations of a group of Monos, as they're called, which I believe means little monkeys, and the sort of rites of passage that they go through as they struggle to look after a prisoner of war that the guerrillas have captured, and they're bossed about by their sort of captain, and they're told to take this prisoner of war up into the jungle. It's sort of Heart of Darkness, it's Apocalypse Now, it's beautifully filmed.
It's got a great soundtrack as well.
Wonderful soundtrack by Mika Levi, who did Under the Skin. And it's just one of those universal, amazing films that will actually leave you changed once you've watched it.
So who else is on the jury? Because Hayley Squires
from I, Daniel Blake. Our chairman was Wash Westmoreland, who made Colette and Still Alice, and various other people on this jury who had to decide what made a best film.
And you were the only journalist there.
I was the only journalist there.
What a privilege.
What was that like?
It was amazing. And you know what? It was actually a real pleasure to watch 10 films and purely concentrate on that and really talk about the artistry and the craft of films. But to do that with people who actually do direct films, do produce films and do act in films, and to talk about performance and the actual logistics of pulling off certain scenes with people who actually make it. Usually when we're watching a film, we're all talking about it from just point of view of a consumer. So to actually discuss each of these films with people who make it was really, really interesting. And I hope we made a good choice. On Saturday night, people who'd bought a ticket for the surprise film didn't know what the winner would be, and they just got that film to watch, so I hope they enjoyed it. But, you know, there were other great films in that category. We also loved St. Maud, which is a debut film from Rose Glass, a British horror about a young nurse who is fervently religious and the horrific lengths that goes to. And Moffy, which is a South African film about a whole generation that was conscripted into the army during the 80s. There was some great films. And also, you know, the festival had a massive array of fantastic films on and closed last night with The Irishman.
Which you were at as well.
Which I was at as well. 3.5 hours, baby.
Oh, I mean,
that's
you were
dedication.
Walking the red carpet with Martin Scorsese, Bobby De Niro.
Al Pacino, Harvey Keitel. I mean, this is an absolute treat, which
envious.
We will talk about in a future podcast. Yeah, that's going to be a winner for a lot of people and probably an Oscar winner.
Do you think any of the films there will go on to big awards? But
yeah.
Aside from The Irishman, what would be your pick for
I think
Oscars?
Monos will probably be a very strong contender for the Best International Picture. It is Columbia's entry. And it's out in a few days, so everyone can go and see it. And see what they think too. Okay, well, I think we should wrap it up. Thank you for that, boys. That's it for now. So do come back next time for more of the same. And you can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram. And please do let us know if you have a question for us. Just let us know via Twitter and we'll see if we can answer it in our next podcast. So it's goodbye from the boys, from Matthew.
Goodbye.
And from Jack.
Goodbye.
And bye for me. See you next time.